Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll get an update on the Orpheus Project with William Todd Hunt. We'll get a sampling of the music of female hip-hop performer Devmo. We'll profile a new business in town, Harbor Tea and Spices, with guest Janice McMahon and Nancy DeCherney. We'll be here with Arts Up because it's Thursday. Looking at the weather, rest of today mostly sunny, highs around 70. Southwest winds to 10 tonight, mostly cloudy with lows around 50. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-60s with southwest winds to 10. And Friday night, numerous rain showers with lows around 50. So enjoy it and stay tuned for Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Seminole Tribe of Florida and the state are ending a legal fight over gaming. The Associated Press reports the two sides agreed Wednesday to end a lawsuit over blackjack tables at tribal casinos. Under the settlement, the tribe will keep blackjack and the state will continue to receive revenue. The tribe and state had a deal which expired in 2015, which triggered the lawsuit. The Oneida Nation of Wisconsin is sponsoring a women's professional golf tournament, which is taking place near Green Bay through the weekend. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio has more on the tribe's involvement, which includes promoting tourism and boosting the economy.
The Oneida own Thornberry Creek. The tribe has also put up the $2 million in prize money that convinced the Ladies Professional Golf Association, or LPGA, to hold an event in Wisconsin. Tournament and course director Josh Dockstater is a member of the Oneida Nation of the Thames in Ontario. He says the Wisconsin Oneida wanted to make Thornberry Creek a tourism destination and particularly aimed at the women's golf tour.
Historically, in Oneida culture, it's a matriarchal society where, you know, we absolutely value women because they give life. And it was just a great fit for us.
Dockstater says the Oneida also want to promote the tribe's hotels, casino, and other companies.
It's bringing a spotlight to tribally owned businesses that can do big business and do it the right way. You know, I think it tells a great story. It helps also tell a story about the culture, the history, and kind of their movement from poverty to prosperity.
Dockstater predicts crowds of between 50,000 and 70,000 for the week. That's even though the Wisconsin competition is sandwiched between two LPGA major tournaments and several of the top golfers won't be at Thornberry Creek. The Oneida say they plan to run the Wisconsin tournament at least two more years. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Tribes on the northern plains are going through a very hot, dry start to the month. Some communities are seeing triple digits, which is elevating fire danger. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The Rapid City Regional Airport had a temperature of 99 degrees at 7 o'clock Wednesday night. The western South Dakota city reached a record high of 105. Temperatures on the Pine Ridge, Cheyenne River, and Rosebud reservations reached 100 degrees or above as well. Alex Calderon with the National Weather Service says this heat wave has been around for a while.
In this area, they tend to not last more than maybe just a few days. We will normally at some point see some cold air come back in from Canada where we, instead of seeing highs in the 90s to 100, we drop back down into the 70s and 80s. In this case, though, the high pressure looks to be strong enough that it's not really wanting to move from where it is in the western U.S. So it's going to continue to bring us hot air through the weekend and even into early next week.
Officials say the combination of heat, very dry weather, and wind is making for a very dangerous situation for fires in the region. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
The Unity Wellness Warrior app is being unveiled this week at the United National Indian Tribal Youth Convention taking place in Denver, Colorado. The app is designed to track wellness from a cultural perspective, such as fitness through cultural dance and healthy eating with traditional foods. The agenda has a key component of health, and Native youth will focus on both physical and mental health. More than 1,000 young people and advisors from across the country are gathering for the five-day event, which runs through Monday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
And by Humboldt State University, we know what it means to be rooted in community. You can get your Master's of Social Work and amplify your voice without having to leave it. The part-time online program accepts applications between August 1st and 31st. More at humboldt.edu/socialwork.
Yate, the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Navajo Nation Head Start School Readiness Conference, August 21st through the 24th. Information on this event and services at siabq.org. Hakuanet.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, and at the board is Jeff Brown producing the show today. Thank you, Jeff. My first guest is William Todd Hunt. He has had a number of incarnations, and we're discussing the latest. He serves as the artistic director of the Orpheus Project. And I asked him, wait a minute, I thought you were with Opera To Go. So we're going to talk about that transformation of Opera To Go to its new moniker, which is Orpheus Project. Welcome,
yeah,
first
thank
of
you.
All. Glad Thanks. To have you Thanks. Here. You've done so much for music in our community.
I try. Thanks.
And so you are the artistic director mm-hmm. for Orpheus Project. Tell us how it morphed into that name and mm-hmm. focus from its predecessor identity.
Sure. Yeah, so Opera To Go was founded, longer than that. It was 1996, and Joyce
that was,
Perry
that
Moore.
That would be 21 years.
That would be, really, I said 12, and it's like, well, that's not nearly long enough. So Joyce Perry Moore founded it as an education outreach thing, actually along with Juneau Lyric Opera, to bring opera and opera scenes into schools and have kids come in contact with opera. And she did that for a while and eventually wanted more control over what she was doing and created her own nonprofit out of that, called it, of course, Opera To Go, and started doing bigger and bigger productions every year until she left in 2007, I believe it was, or it was 2008. And that's when I took over as artistic director. And since those first years of taking opera and going to schools and that kind of thing, Opera To Go, the name made a lot of sense. We have lately, in the past few years, been doing a lot more than just opera. So the opera moniker was a little bit too narrow, we felt. And also we weren't doing as much, touring as we had done in the past, like to other cities in Southeast or even around Alaska as far away as Kotzebue we've gone, which is amazing in and of itself. So actually broadening our scope was a big thing for that our board wanted to expand the mission. And so we actually spent probably 2 years trying to come up with names and finally settled on Orpheus Project. Orpheus being the mythical singer and instrumentalist whose beloved wife was bitten by a snake and died, and he went down to the underworld and with his brilliant singing and playing was able to bring her back, although she ended up turning around and, taken back down. And there's different endings to that story.
So there's a lesson.
There's a lesson.
If you want to avoid hell, start singing.
That's right.
Or at least enjoying vocal performances.
Right.
Let's talk about some mm-hmm. of the vocal performances. How did Opera To Go change? You said we had been doing so much more. Mm-hmm. Describe what
sure.
now Orpheus Project
so,
includes.
Yeah, one of the things we are really proud of is actually helping out other organizations do their thing. A couple of the biggest are Theater at Latitude 58, which we've helped them produce some of their larger productions in the past 3 or 4 years now. And the Juneau Community Bands is another big one that we help on a regular basis and actually have a fairly close partnership with as
well.
So
when you say we help them, what mm-hmm. kind of support do you provide?
Well, we give nonprofit help. It's like we're able to facilitate getting them grant money, better rates for performing venues and that kind of thing. I mean, as well as years of just producing experience, knowing who to talk to, how to get things done, that sort of thing. And, of course, with the community bands, there's lots of different organizations in that. There's the Taku Winds, which I conduct on a regular basis, which is like the wind ensemble. And they do, usually two or three concerts a year. There's like the Reindeer Band and the Volunteer Marching Band, which you just saw in the parade
sure.
the other day. So there's lots of opportunities there for wind players. So that's one of the things, is we've really expanded past doing opera, which you could think of as primarily a vocal thing. And I mean, maybe it's because I'm an instrumentalist by trade, but the instrumental arts are important as well.
What projects are coming up then mm-hmm. for Orpheus Project?
So our next season is a little different. So we were talking a little, during the break about this big opera commission we have, which I'm going to plug as often as I can in the next year or so. We're working on an opera, brand new opera, based on the Princess Sophia disaster that happened at Vanderbilt Reef almost 100 years ago.
October
1918, yes. And so for the 100th anniversary of that disaster, we're planning on a brand new opera to be brought to the public. Dave Hunsecker is working on the libretto and is going to be the stage director. Emerson Eads, who's a Fairbanks composer, is writing the music, and it's at least two-thirds, probably three-quarters of the way done now. Every day I see a little bit more of it.
How
in Dropbox.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Oh, it'll
be super
very,
exciting.
Very Alaskan.
it's going to be great. Yes, totally. And so we're actually going to workshop that in March of 2018. We'll have a whole week. It's March, I want to say 12, starting in March 12. And we'll have rehearsals for the music, working up to, we're shooting for a full performance, musical performance of the piece somewhere, but also lectures and, about what happened there, design talks about what we're doing with the, visually with the opera, sort of sets and costumes and all that kind of stuff, as well as historic lectures as well. So it'll be like a big full week.
Why don't you give, in a nutshell, for mm-hmm. our listeners who may not be familiar with the history mm-hmm. of the sinking of that rather large ship
yes.
In 1918, 18. What mm-hmm. happened? Because as we were chatting prior to going on the air, as you said, it was indeed an operatic situation and experience, and the drama hardly could be surpassed.
Right.
Why don't you describe that?
Yeah, sure. Just in a nutshell, real fast, it was the end of the season. The gold rushers were trying to all get down to essentially Vancouver. They're leaving Skagway. And it was late October. You can imagine the weather was awful. The captain just wanted to try to beat the storm and get to port, so he, was going real fast. Their navigation was off by a couple of degrees, and they hit Vanderbilt Reef at full speed. Landed right up on top of it, where they stayed for 40 hours. The storm was so bad, all of the rescue ships couldn't get close because it was too dangerous. And the captain, because it was the way the ship was designed, he was thinking, even though there were some tears in there, it would, once the tide came in, it would just float off and they could, get to shore. That was the plan, but that's not what happened. The high tide lifted it up, spun it around, and it broke, and the boiler exploded, killed everyone on board, 350 souls or so, and it's the worst naval disaster, I believe, on the west coast of the United States.
Dramatic.
Very dramatic. And, of course,
situation.
40 hours, everybody, is still alive, of course, and essentially unhurt during those 40 hours.
Hard to imagine. So tell me why. Why commission an opera? Mm-hmm. It sounds like a huge undertaking with many, many moving parts
it
and a
really
lot of challenges.
It is our second big opera commission. Our last one was from Rory Stitt a few years ago, the opera Bennu, which I hope you all saw, was fantastic. And so after that giant ordeal, we're ready to jump into it again. And the 100th, commemorating that 100-year anniversary seemed like the time to do it. And it's just the right story and just the right creative team too. So I'm very excited.
How do you raise money for that? In other words, how do you even predict what the costs are?
Right.
I assume you pay the librettist, you pay the conductor, you pay the you don't have to pay for rights because you're developing it.
Right, exactly, but that doesn't make it that much cheaper.
Bringing all of those resources together, how do you even anticipate what the cost might be?
Yeah, this is going to be easily our biggest budget show, so we're going to do lots of fundraising as the year goes on. And actually, the workshop week will certainly have some of that as well. Hosting dinners or, silent auctions and of course, grants and all that kind of thing. So we've got actually a team of people. Usually it's just me writing a grant or two for our typical production, but we've got a team of people.
And you have a name for it?
That's a good question. We've just been calling it Princess Sophia, but we'll see, I guess.
Horrible shipwreck.
The big horrible shipwreck.
No kidding.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. In case you're just joining us here on a Juno afternoon, we're chatting with William Todd Hunt. He is the artistic director of the Orpheus Project. It is an opera-oriented organization, and we're talking about an original production of an opera targeted for 2018, commemorating the tragic sinking of the Princess Sophia in October of 1918. William, let me ask you, what brought you to opera? Do you have an early memory of hooking you?
Yeah,
I
can tell you exactly. I was classical saxophone major in undergrad. And, of course, what are you going to do?
Are there a lot
classes?
Of those?
No. So
probably
I was like,
not.
Okay, I need to try to, make a living here doing this. So that's when I got into conducting. And I did some opera musical theater conducting when I was in undergrad as well. But my first wife was a singer turned stage director. And we went to graduate school together, and we ended up doing lots of opera together. And that's really what got me, full bore, interested in it.
What appeals to you about it?
It's the excessively high drama. it's one of those art forms that I think a lot of people have trouble with it because if they're really trying to give it a chance, have trouble with it maybe because the intensity of emotion is so high.
And it's often in another language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a barrier to some people. These days, we tend to use supertitles, so like the opera equivalent of subtitles in a foreign movie, so that you actually understand even better than if it were in English and you weren't able to read it just from, difficulty understanding sung words is often, an issue.
What other projects does Orpheus have ahead of it? Mm-hmm. Certainly, you've probably got some smaller efforts.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Sophia.
And this season, we don't have a large production, which is the first time in quite a number of years we haven't. But we do have a few concerts, which I'm excited about. The first one is going to be November 11 and 12. At Northern Light Church, the Amalga Chamber Orchestra is back, and we will be doing a program of music focused on Southeast Alaska, essentially. So there will be some music from the Princess Sophia Opera.
Oh,
we're
gonna,
excerpt that and put it on stage, sort of as the, whet people's appetite for that, along with local composer Artemio Sandoval, who's writing a piece for us to be premiered. Then, which is also a local subject. And there's this big symphony on the concert isn't decided yet, but it's probably going to be Ellen Hovhaness, who was from Seattle. And that's a nice little connection there. So that's the first concert in November. Then the workshop would be in March, starting the 12th of March for a week. And in April, I'm actually really excited about this because we're doing something totally new. April 21st and 22nd at the Egan Library and Northern Light on Saturday night and Sunday afternoon, respectively, a concert we're calling Continuum, which is a concert that juxtaposes music of the 21st century with music of the 14th century. Yeah, so I've been having a grand old time just sort of imagining putting these two things together.
Greatest Hits, 1381.
Yeah. So the 14th century had wild, wild, crazy music. It was a crazy century with lots of political and war, or political upheaval and war and horrible things. It's the
plague.
Yeah, the plague
happened,
the Great
in that,
Schism,
yes,
and the papacy. Lots of wild things happening. And
plenty
the music,
of drama. Mm-hmm,
and the music reflects this too, I think. And so juxtaposing the, you know, new music with that, I think, is a really, it's just full of possibilities.
Well, it sounds like a huge level of creativity, mm-hmm, and a bit of a pivot to some local Southeast and Alaska-oriented music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I think that especially in a place like this that is so connected to where we live, that, you know, finding art, you know, arts that speak to us on a local level, I think is very important.
Well, thank you for joining me today.
Well,
we're talking with William Todd Hunt. He is the Artistic Director of Orpheus Project. If folks wanted to learn more about the Orpheus Project and or the Princess Sophia Opera Project, where might they look?
So our website is probably the best place right now, which is orpheusproject.org, orpheusproject.org. Or you can still go to our old website, which is operatogo.net, and it all points to the same place. And we're building web pages for all of the events right now. On Facebook, too, there will be, as time goes on, more information on there, but I'm trying to get it all up on the website.
Well, thanks
first.
For the heads up. Appreciate you coming
in.
Yeah,
my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 6th of July, 2017. 1885, on this day, Louis Pasteur successfully tested his rabies vaccine on a 9-year-old boy named Joseph Meister, who had been bitten by a rabid dog. It's the birthday of the artist Frida Kahlo, born just outside Mexico City, 1907, a painter who said, "Critics thought I was a surrealist, but I wasn't. I never painted dreams. I painted my own reality." It was on this day in 1928, the first full-length talking picture, The Lights of New York, premiered at the Strand Theater in New York City, the first 100% talking picture. Al Jolson's The Jazz Singer had come out earlier, but it had only brief intervals of sound. It's the birthday of the novelist Eleanor Clark, born in Los Angeles, 1913. Her first novel, The Bitter Box, came out in 1946, about a bank clerk who quits his job to become involved in the Communist Party. Her best-known work is a nonfiction book, a book about oysters, the oysters of Locmaria Cay, in which she wrote about the oyster industry in northwestern France. Eleanor Clark wrote, "If you don't love life, you can't enjoy an oyster. There's a shock of freshness to it, and intimations of the ages of man, some piercing intuition of the sea and all its weeds and breezes. They shiver you for a split second." When she was in her 60s, Eleanor Clark came down with an eye disease that made it almost impossible to read, so she tried writing with magic markers on huge drawing pads, and she went on to write 4 more books. And it was on this day, 1896, the writer O. Henry got on a train for New Orleans rather than stand trial for embezzlement. He'd been a bookkeeper in a bank in Austin, Texas, and there were shortages, probably due to bad bookkeeping, and so he might have escaped conviction. But on his way from Houston to Austin to stand trial, He lost his nerve, stepped across the platform, boarded a train going to New Orleans, went down to Central America. The next year, word reached him that his wife was dying, and he went back to Austin, Texas, knowing that he faced a certain prison sentence. His wife died. He was 5 years in a penitentiary, and there he began to write short stories, which he published under the name of one of the guards, Orrin Henry, O. Henry. Here's a poem for today by David Hernandez, Sincerely, The Sky. Yes, I see you down there, looking up into my vastness. What are you hoping to find on my vacant face, there within the margins of telephone wires? You should know I am only bright blue now because of physics. Molecules break and scatter my light from the sun more than any other color. You know my variations, azure at noon, navy by midnight. How often I find you then on your patio, pajamaed and distressed, head thrown back so your eyes can pick apart, not the darker version of myself, but the carousel of stars. To you, I am merely background. You barely hear my voice. Remember, I am most vibrant when air breaks my light. Do something with your brokenness. Sincerely, The Sky, a poem by David Hernandez from his collection Dear Sincerely, published by University of Pittsburgh Press and used by permission here in the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, a monthly devoted to discovering and publishing new voices in poetry. More at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And thanks for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. I'm today's volunteer host, Lori Scandling. With me is Janice McCann. She is the owner of a new business, Harbor Tea and Spice, at the Senate Building downtown on Franklin. Janice, talk about why tea and why spice. There already is a tea shop, and there's a spice shop, too. So talk about your motivation there and what made you think this would be a good business.
First of all, the first business was the Red Onion in the Valley. It's a bulk tea and spice, not service in terms of serving tea. It's basically for your spicing up your food and your flavor, or making your own teas if you prefer. We do make some spice blends and some tea blends ourselves.
So you own the Red Onion as well, the spice shop?
Yes. Okay. And a lady came in and said, oh, we would love to have a shop like this downtown. And as it turns out, there was a space and there was an opportunity to do that. So after 6 months of remodeling and doing all of the work that it takes to open a shop, we finally opened on June 17th.
You mentioned as we were chatting that there are more than 250 varieties of tea and spices at the shops.
Yes.
How do you get that tea in so many varieties? Spices, of course, we know there are dozens and dozens. What about teas? How do you make those connections, and how do you learn about the variety of teas that there are in the world?
Well, it's very interesting. Tea's an interesting thing. There's lots of varieties. There's lots of names of teas. Most teas come from the same plant. You have different kinds of teas, but they are picked at different times, or they're different parts of the leaf, or like a white tea, for instance, is at the very budding of the leaves, and so they pick those, and so it's very mild. Your orange pekoe comes from another layer of the leaves. And then other teas come from different layers of the leaves.
But essentially the same plant.
It's essentially the same plant.
And what about your spices? How are you selecting those? It seems like grocery stores offer the most common spices. So how is what you're offering different?
It's different in that we have a larger variety, for one thing. Also, we get them in fresh from our suppliers. So I think I can guarantee that they're going to be probably a little fresher than maybe what you would get in the bottles on the grocery stores. Who knows how long they've been there or when they were necessarily bottled. They may have an expiration date on them. But we try to carry them in bulk. Because of the turnover, our herbs and spices are very fresh.
Tell me about some of the more unusual spices that someone may find in your shop.
Some of them that like the Sichuan peppercorns, Sichuan berries, really. It's a little plant that bears a berry that is very peppery and pepper-like, although it's not officially a pepper. But it's something that people look for, and so far we've been the only people that carry that. An herb or a spice called sumac, which is a ground spice, again, from a berry of a plant. It's used in Middle Eastern cooking a lot. It's used for a higher note in the flavor, such as which you would use a citrus for. And so the sumac gives that higher note, just like the tamarind tree paste gives that higher note in Indian cooking. So it's used in a blend called Zatar.
What's the genesis of your interest in spices or teas?
I've been into natural health and healthy living all my life, and which includes herbs and herbal teas and herbal blends, using them not only in cooking, but in various ways medicinally. You know, you can use them for poultices, you can use them in extracts, all kinds of ways of using those herbs. And I prefer to just use them simply, and I think infusing them in water, in hot water, in tea, you get micronutrients from the leaves. You get vitamins and minerals and things that infuse into the water that you probably wouldn't get necessarily in a vitamin pill.
And did you have to do a lot of research to gain a better understanding of the teas and spices being sold at Red Onion, because now you own another business as well?
Yes, and that's what I love. I love learning. I'm an eternal student, and I keep a beginner's mind, so to speak, so that everything I look at, it's fresh, and my, you know, it's a new way of looking at things always. And so we just keep learning, you know, and it's fascinating. And the spice trade itself is fascinating.
In what way?
Well, it's probably one of the oldest businesses on the planet in terms of the old spice ships and spice traders.
It certainly drove exploration Magellan, for example.
It drove exploration. Spices used to be worth more than gold in many countries. And so there's a lot of different stories and different things around the spice trade as far as people gaining access to those different spices. And there's old spice routes and, you know, the Silk Road, and there's ship routes. And
a lot of conquest, now that you mention it, associated with the pursuit of spices.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of my interesting stories is one of the islands where the Dutch had taken over, they grew cloves, and they had clove trees. And the natives would plant a tree every time a child was born. It would be their birth trees. But the Dutch decided they wanted to control the clove trade, so they decided they would burn some of the trees and just to make it more rare, that kind of thing. And evidently, the natives really rebelled when they began to do that, and so there was a total insurrection. But they ended up burning so many of the clove trees that people couldn't live on the island very well anymore. And when the soldiers and the guards would come from the Dutch, they could only live there about 6 months, and then they'd have to leave. And what was going on is the acids and the air from the volcanoes was no longer being filtered by the clove trees. And so the health of the entire island went down after they...
Due to the desirability of one spice.
That's right, exactly, or the control of one spice.
We're talking with Janice McCann. She is the owner of a new business in the Senate Building downtown on Franklin called Harbor Tea and Spice. So, Janice, if I were to come into one of your shops and say, I'm kind of interested in a spice to use with, and let's say I give you a sample food like pork or sweet potatoes, would you be able to, or would someone at the counter there be able to consult with me and advise me on the use of spices?
I think so. I don't know everything, and I would not pretend to know everything about it. I'm learning, too, but it's fun to explore, and it would be fun to explore with you what it is that you like, what kind of flavors that you do like. And so something that would be compatible with your taste as well as with the dish that you're trying to create.
And can you buy any amount, meaning could you buy small sample amounts?
Yes. Yes, we don't have any limits. You can buy one teaspoon to as much as we have.
We should emphasize that the Tea and Spice Shop, Harbor Tea and Spice Downtown, is not a sit-down place to drink tea.
Correct.
It is a place to buy bulk dried spices and tea, as well as is red onion then out mm-hmm. in the valley.
That's true. And our spice blends that we make and our tea blends that we make, and we also carry some tea blends that other companies make. We have dishware, teacups, and lots of infusers to use.
How do you decide what to blend?
I think you have to decide what you want to accomplish with that blend. If there's something you go, I really got a cold, I feel like I'm getting sick, so you might want something to help build your immune system, say. So you would go to some of the herbs and spices that are high in vitamin C, for instance, like hibiscus or rose hips. Also, cayenne. I created a blend called Hot Juicy because everything I had in it had vitamin C in it, but I also put some cayenne to give it a little kick, and it was actually pretty good.
Sounds interesting. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Janice. Janice is the owner of Harbor Tea and Spice in the Senate Building downtown and also the Red Onion Tea and Spice shop out in the valley.
Could we make one announcement that we're having an open house this Saturday?
Oh, very good. Okay.
At the Harbor Tea and Spice, and also the first Friday. So this weekend is our open house weekend.
What time on Saturday is your open house?
We are open from 9 until 8 every day of the week.
Oh, all day.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate you coming by and sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Wimbledon, the greatest of all tennis tournaments, reaches its exciting climax the first week of July.
13, love.
The scene at the All England Lawn Tennis Club is legendary. The verdant green of the courts, throngs of fans in sun hats spooning strawberries and cream, sightings of royalty, and lots of pigeons. For many years, since the tournament began in 1877, pigeons nested in the stands, bobbled about on the courts, and, well, made a mess of things. Yet today, very few pigeons attend Wimbledon. Fans can thank Wayne Davis and his Harris's hawk named Rufus. Davis, a longtime falconer, takes Rufus to the Wimbledon grounds a few times a week throughout the year. Rufus soars over the venerable courts, a truly scary sight for any other feathered visitors. The pigeons get the message, move elsewhere and don't come back soon. A non-toxic solution to that problem. Oh, and when Rufus isn't busy at Wimbledon, He's patrolling Westminster Abbey. Writers for BirdNote include Bob Sundstrom, Todd Peterson, Dennis Paulson, and Ellen Blackstone. I'm Mary McKim.
And thanks for staying with us on a Juno afternoon. My next guest is female hip-hop artist Dev Mo. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Straight out of L.A., or should we say Santa Monica? Glad to have you join us. So what brings you to Juno? And we should say that your full name is Devin Moses.
Yes.
So Dev Mo is...
Now everybody knows.
It comes right out of who you are.
Right.
How?
Right.
What brought you to Juno then?
I'm actually here to get away. I have a friend who moved here for the summer, so I'm kind of just visiting. But right now, I'm kind of a little bit in like a writer's block. I'm struggling to work on songs and music, so I thought it might be nice to just get away for a week and be in nature for once. I took a breath in when I got out of the airport, and I've never smelled such fresh air in my life because I've been in L.A. for so long. So I guess the city was just, there's just too much activity happening all the time, and I just need to get away and kind of like readjust myself. So yeah, and already I've been here. I got in last night at 9, and I'm already like extremely inspired.
Well, welcome.
Yeah.
How did you get into rap? Rap is a very male-dominated, well, much of the music industry is very male-dominated. What led you to rap?
My family is, we have like a lot of rhythm in our family, and I've always loved poetry. And like when I was younger, I would like play guitar and I would songwrite. But specifically rap, my family moved to the West Coast when I was 14. And I was introduced to like West Coast hip hop. I fell in love with Tupac. And so I kind of started there because at home I would like rap all the lyrics by myself, but like didn't want anyone to know. So I was kind of like a closet rapper. And then I met some friends who were in rap and music, I mean, in high school, and I asked them if I could jump on a track, and they were hesitant, but once I finally got there, or once they let me like rap on one of their tracks, they actually were like, oh, she's pretty good. And I kind of just spiraled from there. It's been like a snowball effect of, you know, great things.
Now, can you do it truly ad hoc, or are you a spoken word rapper? How do you develop those lyrics both ways?
I always need music, so I always write to music, and I'm just a writer, so I wouldn't be like a freestyler or anything. Mm-hmm. Everything is very thought out. I write and then I rewrite, which a lot of rappers don't do. A lot of it is freestyled or just an initial writing session. But for me, it's very much songwriting. It's not just, you know, this quick thing. You know, I have to really think about it. I want it to be intricate. I want there to be a message. So it's very important for me to write and rewrite.
So I'm going to describe for our listeners, because this is radio, not to be stereotypical, but you look like you have stepped out of the Irish countryside with your fair skin and your beautiful red hair and your blue-gray eyes.
I am unique.
You're female. What kind of boundaries or challenges have you run into in the rap world?
That's a very good question. Thank you. Challenges. I don't really see them as challenges. I love challenges. I really do. I love proving people wrong because I think people doubt me initially every time. And my favorite thing is to just go up there and, like, rock their world and then have them be like, whoa, we had no idea that, like, this little white girl could do it, you know. So for me, it's not a challenge. I definitely get a lot of attention. The second that I'm on a stage at a rap show, everyone is, what's this girl going to do? You know, they have that face like, So I think it's beneficial. I get everyone's attention. You know, I'm different looking. I've got crazy red hair, as you can see. So I don't see it as like a bad thing. I see it as like a really good thing for me.
Have you met other female rappers? Have you worked?
Plenty.
It's not strictly a male.
It's not
sport,
strictly
as it were.
Right. It's not a strictly male dominated world. I mean, it is male dominated, but it's not strictly male sport. I think there's like two super famous female rappers, and there's so many men, but yet when a girl starts rapping, people want to compare us to the two most famous female rappers. And that's what I think is unfair, because we all have a different voice and we're all talking about different things. And I don't understand how there can be hundreds and hundreds of male rappers, but there's two females and we all get compared to them. So, you know, for me, I definitely think like I want to help change that. And I want to encourage like other females to start rapping, because it's not like we're lifting weights. Everybody can write poetry. Everybody can make music, you know.
Rap has often been criticized for some of the language in terms of it being misogynistic.
Totally.
And how do you approach rap?
I think like initially what attracted me to rap is like how powerful of a art form it is. When I would hear rappers, I would think, you know, I looked up to them. Like, I felt so powerless as like a young, small female growing up that's kind of what I turned to get my power. I'm sorry, what was the question?
Talking about some of the lyrics conveyed a disrespect for women.
Totally.
Or violence prone.
Right. So yeah, I guess I took the elements of power from that and I made it my own. A lot of the misogyny in rap, I don't co-sign. I don't appreciate it, but it's not my music, you know. My music is very, like, girl power. I like to stick up for the underdog. I like to show girls that they can do what any male can do in this industry or, you know, anywhere.
Really. And do you see yourself staying in that genre of music, or are you exploring other genres?
I'm exploring. My last, the EP that I just put out in February, it's called Call It a Night, and a lot of it is, like, singing and rapping. So what I'm going to play for you guys is something from that new EP. And so I think it's like a nice combination of the two.
Yeah. We're talking with Deb Mo. She is a female rapper who is visiting Juneau for inspiration.
Oh, yeah.
Will you have any performances?
At the moment, no. There is an open mic tonight at the Alaskan.
Of
and I'm
course.
Thinking about just,
absolutely.
Just having some fun and meeting some people and maybe like doing a little performance. But as of now, no like official performances.
Well, welcome to Juneau. Let's take a
thank
listen
you.
To some of your music. Glad to have you join us today.
All right. Thank you. Wake up, eyes peel, four corners in the thrill. Same life all over again. Same haters, same friends, same block, my same thoughts. Same dreams, same problems, same fear that it's just a hobby. And I'll be taking calls in an office lobby. Same clothes and the same foods, same songs that I sang to. Same me, same you, same job that I drive to. And the same car that I've been driving with the same secrets I've been hiding. They say you're gonna make it, but I've been trying. They say people change, but they've been mine, so. I'ma run away to a different place. I'ma run away, cause I need a change. Every day I wake up and it's all the same. I'ma run away, cause I need my space.
Between the fake folks and the mean jokes, my dreams couldn't seem any further, and it feels like I'm gonna be stuck in high.
Listening to some Deb Mo. She's visiting Juneau, and if you're interested in checking her out, she may be at the open mic tonight, which typically begins at 9 o'clock at the Alaskan. Speaking of stuff to do, hey, First Friday is tomorrow. Hi,
oh
Nancy
DeTourney.
Oh, my gosh, DeTourney.
Yes, and we've got preludes to the coming
well,
attractions,
please
too.
Please tell us what we should know about. And, moreover, it will be sunny.
And beautiful.
Walkable.
Wow, what's that like?
I don't know. We're going to find out. So tell us what we should be paying attention to for our First Friday weekend coming up.
All right. Well, this evening at 7 p.m., Sasha, Dr. Alexander Tutinov is doing a piano concert with all of the pianists who helped raise the money to buy the brand new piano for
the Schimmler,
as I recall. And it shimmers, let me tell you.
And it is a free concert.
Yes, it is.
It's a free.
It's a
7
celebration
o'clock.
Is what it is. So.
And that will be right across the street at the Jack.
Yeah. This is your last weekend to see Running with Pretty Sharp Things, and I have to say I enjoyed it completely and thoroughly, and I strongly recommend that you make time this weekend to go see it if you haven't.
Word of mouth is
very
funny.
Thank you for sharing that. Outright prolonged laughter. There's music. There's singing. There's dancing. There's everything you want. It's good for the whole family. There's an 8-year-old boy in the whole thing. So
What's not to like?
And, you know, Aaron wrote it. And so it's a wonderful...
Aaron Elmore.
Yes, you should...
Playwright extraordinaire.
So 7:30 Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and then 2 p.m. on Sunday. Don't miss it.
And are they up at McFeeders Hall?
Yes.
That is their typical home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That is their home, and there's only 80 seats, so
okay.
Better get there. Okay, also this evening at from 8 to 9:30 is Salsa and Bachata Lessons out on Anka Street. If you need the address to that, go to our website and look on the calendar. That's jahc.org. Okay, let's see. There's Iron Roots Strength Academy happening on Friday morning. Then we have all the First Friday things, which start at 4:30.
Oh, 4:30.
Well,
okay.
Some are 4:30. We have come to our place and get this cute little map of where you're supposed to go. We have Parsing Jabberwocky by Cameron Vance. It's a wonderfully colorful, beautiful exhibit that I think it might be her first, and it's just delightful. So start there and get this.
At the Jack.
Mm-hmm. And it's also followed by the Block Party with DJ Manu, a beer garden, all sorts of fun. You know, if it's nice like this, we'll probably have the garage doors open, be running back and forth.
And in the past, there's been some dancing on the plaza at the APK. Is that on tap?
We'll call that at 3:30.
Game time decision.
Yes,
understood.
That's right. COPA has Intertidal by Patty Hutchins Jupy. She was one of the artists in residence out at the Greening Cabin, you know, that program that they do.
Oh, it's a beautiful place.
Inspirational for
to be inspired.
For
so absolutely.
You can come see what she did. And as you're walking from COPA, having just had your COPA ice cream, I'm sure, you can stop at Juno Froyo, where they're having 20% off for First Friday. At the Walter Sobloff Building, First Friday is free. Entrance is free. You can see the Alaska Native Masks exhibit,
absolutely,
which is
world-class
stunning
art there.
They have Rhonda Butler and Renee Culp doing work, so you can watch them doing their various things. Rainy Retreat Books is under new management.
We got a chance to talk to the new owner the other day, Tori Weaver and Alexi Painter.
Yes, and they are having a big bang opening Friday, 5 to 7. The Flustered Cluckers, of course, Alexi's part of that group, and Rob Cohen will be performing, and you just come on down and kick off a new
right
bookstore.
There on Franklin.
Yep. Downtown Dames.
Seward
Street. Downtown Dames has Levi Chilton. He's a jewelry maker.
Wonderful
jewelry,
carver.
Beautiful, yes. Love and Matter, which is just up the street a little bit, has Branching Threads with Grant Ainsworth. All sorts of hand screen printed Alaskan scenes on T-shirts and such. Franklin Street over at Barnaby Brewing. There's K.M. Perry Photos, and they're releasing their Salmonberry Lambic. If you like a lambic beer, that's for you, I
Do
bet.
Do you know what a lambic beer is, Nancy?
I should. I'm married to
a man. You are married to a wine expert.
Yes, but it's a particular style of beer, and it's often raspberry lambics, and it's a little bit on the sweeter side, I think, and I think it's exciting that they're
doing
the salmon berries. Worth visiting, checking it out, yes. And Amalga Distillery will have Barnacle Foods there, and there will be a photo essay from... various other, I don't know who the photos are, but it says there's a photo essay. So,
if you
okay.
haven't seen the distillery at the old Capital City Weekly and Juno Empire and AELNP office, it is a beautiful use of space.
Beautiful.
14-foot windows and lots of wonderful light right there on the corner.
Concrete bars, beautiful.
The use of wood is lovely as well. So
and
it's right there at 2nd and Franklin.
Go there. Have fun. On Front Street, the Alaska Fish and Chip Company has Jocelyn Miles and Luke Weld performing, and they start at 7 o'clock, so you can come from the block party and go right over to the hangar on the wharf for the Fish and Chips Company and enjoy that. Annie Kales has Natalie Parento and Peter Von Gaza, who are from Whitehorse, paintings and black and white photography.
We can call that an international exhibit.
Exactly.
It's from over the border.
As we cross the way here. It's like, let's see, we have Aunt Claudia's Dolls, which has been closed for a little while, is reopening. And this is one of those little secret things that if you've never been to, have you been?
I have not.
See,
but
you'd be
I know
ideal
they are
candidate.
Beautiful, world class, and special.
It's a very It's
and
a treat.
How do you get to that shop?
Where the clock is, you go up the hill just a little bit, and there's
a secret door.
A little secret door. It's like going to Harry Potter. Yeah. And you go through the door and up the stairs, and you'll wend your way around. And really, it is an amazing collection of dolls and miniature things and just delightful. So take time to do that one of these days. It's open from 4 to 7. On this first Friday, Kindred Post, M.K. McNaughton will be down there doing quick portraits. So you walk in, you get to have your portrait done by M.K., who's doing a lot of great portrait work, and I think they'll have snacks, too. So stop there. We have a new grand opening, another grand opening.
I'm always happy to hear about that.
Yes.
It keeps our town lively and fresh
so
and
many
interesting.
Exciting things.
Absolutely.
So it's the Harbor Tea and Spice grand opening there in the Senate building.
We just spoke with the owner, Janice McCann, about the impetus for that new shop.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So stop in at...
there in the Senate building.
And in the Senate building, also Kathleen Wiest is in the Juno Artist Gallery. She's usually over in Tenneke or someplace, so it's a nice opportunity to see her. She's back in town. Bustin' Out Boutique is having a bra giveaway. So if you're interested in putting your name in for the hat for a free bra, do that. Just go up the stairs there.
They're expensive.
There. They are expensive. What's up with that?
I know. It's so unfair.
They're so lovely.
Well, got three on now.
Let's go there. The Port is having a local goods market. Check out handmade local goods there.
Yeah, I think the Port, when I've been down to the wharf, and I don't mean the wharf, I should say the docks, I noticed that they have a bunch of local products such as kelp relish and a kelp salsa. Have you tried some?
Yes, they're very good. That's another, young people
starting a new
business.
Thing. I think they'd be terrific stocking stuffers, a unique Juno gift.
Absolutely, and it's great to go down and see. They have other, like Megan's Marms and Meeks artwork is there sometimes. So
some
a lot
sweet
of things.
Selection, and they're right behind the library in that walkway.
I missed out in we have Annie Oikreist at the Canvas. And let's see, something else. There's a piano recital. Franz Felkel, piano and violin recital from 6 to 7 p.m. out at Aldersgate. So if you don't feel like coming downtown, you got something to do out
He's
there.
One of the past winners of the Youth Concerto Concert competition, as I recall, and he is quite a talented young man.
He's now living in Miami and is part of a very well-known quartet. So
he's back.
He's back.
We should take advantage of that.
Go see that.
Did you say 6 o'clock Aldersgate?
6 o'clock.
Okay, that's by the cinema out the road there.
It's a donation to help with the care and feeding of that piano.
Okay.
There's disco roller skating from 6:30 to 7 over at the Treadwell Arena. And as I mentioned, the folks singing, Jocelyn and Luke, over at the Alaska Fish. And the play on Saturday from 10 to 3. It's the second Saturday market out at the Airport Shopping Mall. There's an exhibit at and a talk at the Alaska State Museum from 2 to 3 on Saturday called Looking Great at 150. And they're going to talk about how they care for archival materials and how you can care for your own photographs and stuff like that. So if you have old documents you want to take care of, that's a thing to do. Did you mention Wee Wee?
No.
It's at Rockwell, and it's X-rated. But you should go there at 7.
Saturday night?
Saturday night, 7 and 9 p.m. Yeah.
So from children's activities to X-rated in Juno, as always.
This weekend, and we didn't even make it to
Sunday,
so you'll have to go to the calendar.
This town is never... not busy. We're talking with Nancy DeTourney of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. You can find out what's going on by looking at jahc.org. Thanks for joining.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AF.